Call this meeting of the South Dakota Public Utilities Commission to order. It is August 25th at approximately 9:30 in the morning. We're here at room 413 of the state capitol, and this was the time and place noticed for this commission meeting. I am Commissioner Dusty Johnson. My colleagues Steve Kolbeck and Gary Hansen are also participating in this meeting. My intention is to move the USF dockets to the back of both agendas, as there may be confidential information that needs to be discussed, and then to try to move the Orbitcom Verizon issue toward the front, not first, but we'll sort of deal with some of the dockets we expect to go quicker first, and then we'll – oh, and Cindy Grunewald. Are you on the phone, Ms. Grunewald?
How about Grosvenor? Does that look right?
Grosvenor, that'd be fine.
Right? Oh, I'm here, sir.
All right, with that, let's go ahead and go first to a status update from Ms. Gregg on our consumer contacts.
Thank you, Chairman Johnson. The Commission has received a total of 46 contacts since the last report was prepared for the August 11, 2009 Commission meeting. 19 of the contacts involved telecommunication service, 10 of the contacts involved electric service, 1 contact involved natural gas service, 1 contact involved gas and electric service, 2 contacts involve cell phone service, 8 contacts related to the Do Not Call Registry, and 5 contacts related to issues not regulated by the PUC. 1,592 of the 1,652 complaints received in 2009 have been resolved.
Thank you, Ms. Gregg. Any questions for Ms. Gregg? Any observations about the fair season thus far?
The most popular question that I had when I was there, and I think other staff had too, were the tax credits for energy efficiency that are offered in 2009. So that was a lot of the questions that I had when I was at the fair. So,
great, thanks.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Mr. Commissioner Hanson?
Yeah.
A little bit of difficulty in hearing from this end. I don't know if the others are experiencing that as well, but when Ms. Gregg was speaking, I had a little bit of a challenge hearing her. And can hear you all right.
Yeah, I thought Ms. Gregg was a little faint too, so I think it was probably distance from the microphone. But Commissioner, speak up if others are also tough to hear. All right, with that, we'll proceed to Gary. Did you need Deb to repeat anything?
No, thank you.
Okay, gotcha. With that, we'll proceed to the electric portion of the docket. Item number one does deal with a filing made by Xcel for approval of its tariff revisions and distributed generation interconnection manual. But the question before the commissioner today is, shall the commission grant the request to withdraw the filing? Any comments from Xcel?
Mr. Chairman, Jim Wolfe here. We made this filing early in the interconnection process to show our rules are time, and now the new rules, conclusion of the interconnection making process, filing is no longer necessary. Any risk with all that?
Okay, thanks, Mr. Wilcox. We've got, on our end, some sort of buzzing feedback. That's not unusual when we get a lot of people on the phone, but just a reminder that if there's anything you can do to mute your end of the conversation when you're not talking, that would be great. Thanks. Thanks, Mr. Wilcox. Staff, any comments?
No additional comments from staff. This is really just a cleanup at this point.
Great, thanks. Of course, we've seen dockets like this in the last couple of weeks. Any questions or comments from commissioners or advisors? Hearing none, any action?
I'll motion in EL07-027 that the commission grant the request to withdraw the filing.
Motion has been made. No second is required. Is there any comment on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Kolbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. We'll move to our addendum to take up electric item number one, which deals with filing made by MDU for a similar approval of tariff revisions. And the question again today is, shall the commission grant the request to withdraw the filing? MDU, any comments?
Chairman, this is Tammy Eberly with MDU, and similar to Xcel, we're withdrawing the tariff that and the interconnection guidelines we originally submitted in this docket. I do have a tariff before you as part of this filing just to reference the commission, the rules that do contain the interconnection guidelines. So just a bit of a difference there. I would like to include and continue to have a tariff with a reference to the commission rules rather than to our own our previous interconnection guidelines. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much. Staff, anything additional?
Nothing additional, just that this is a bit different in that staff would recommend approval of the tariff revisions referencing staff's rules and also grant the request to withdraw the previous filing.
Great, thanks. Any questions or comments? Hearing none, I will move that the commission grant the request to withdraw the filing and the commission approve the tariff revisions. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. On our addendum, electric item number 2 does deal with Basin Electric Power Cooperative and their request for an energy conversion facility siting permit for Deer Creek Station. And there was a motion filed altering the timeline just a bit, and at this time we'll hear from Basin Electric.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioners. This is Casey Jacobson on behalf of Basin Electric Power Cooperative. And as you know, South Dakota law requires the applicant of an energy conversion facility to notify landowners within a half mile of the area 30 days before the hearing. In this case, we did not get that notice put out in the required amount of time. So the motion before you today is to request an extension of the notice period, the public input hearing to be rescheduled from September 16th to September 30th. South Dakota law requires that the public hearing be scheduled within 30 days and held within 60. And so this date will extend beyond the 60 days. And then the last item is to extend the intervention period 10 days after the hearing to allow for intervention of people who might attend the hearing.
Great, thanks, Ms. Jacobson. We'll go ahead and at this time also, because they're so similar, also take up hydrocarbon pipeline number 1. Did you have any additional comments? Very similar situation, I presume.
Right. I have no additional comments. Same request on that docket as well.
Thanks very much. Staff, any comments?
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff, and staff would recommend the commission waive SDCO 4941B15 and 16 so as to extend the notice, extend the public hearing time frame, and extend the deadline for application of party status. And the date we have come up with there is October 13, because the 10th falls on a Saturday, the 12th is a holiday, so that Tuesday the 13th would be the intervention deadline.
And is that shifting, what, 12 or 13 days from the original intervention deadline? I forget what it was originally.
The original was September 30th.
Okay, so 13 days.
Yep.
Gotcha, perfect. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, do I understand the suggestion by Ms. Kramer is to have the public hearing on September 30th, or was it October 13th? I was trying to figure out which dates we're talking about.
The hearing is September 30th, and then the intervention deadline would be October 13th.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Jacobson, it seems unlikely that the commission or interveners would need it, but would Basin Electric object to also extending a decisional time frame, 13 days? It would just be unfortunate for any interveners if their ability to make their case was limited by that 2 weeks.
I think that's fair. Basin would have no opposition to extending the deadline to make a decision a year in 13 days.
Sure. Staff, any legal concerns?
None on staff's part, as long as the company is willing.
Great. Other questions? Yes, Commissioner.
Yeah, Ms. Jacobson, we're confident that this is the time that you need. You've got the letters ready. You have a landowner list, and
we have a landowner list. The letter is ready to go. We're just waiting on today's hearing to make sure that that's the correct date, and the letters will be going out tomorrow. I apologize for the inconvenience of having to have this before you. There's no explanation. We just didn't do it in time.
And that's understandable. But I just wanted to make sure that we were giving enough time.
Yep, we're ready to go. We're confident in that.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? Hearing none, any comments or action?
I'll give it a shot here. I'll just try the EL09-015. You want separate motions?
I think we could probably make a single motion. I mean, it'd count as two motions in the minutes, but I think we can vote on them singly. But feel free to make two motions if you'd prefer.
Okay. Well, I'll go in EL09-015 and HP09-002. I will motion that we move the public hearing to September 30th and we waive 41, 49B-15 and 16 and allow for the additional time needed as per staff's request. 49, 41B, 15, and 16, yeah. Move the deadline to October 13th for intervention.
Gotcha. Perfect. Great. Any discussion on the motion? The motions? Hearing none. We'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johns votes aye. Those motions carry 3-0. Thank you. All right. With that, we'll head back to telecommunications item of our dockets. Let's take up telecom item number 3 on the main agenda, which is TC09-082. This deals with a filing for approval of an interconnection agreement between Quest and Matrix Telecom. And the question for the commissioner today is, shall it approve that agreement? Any parties wish to make comment? Hearing none, staff.
The agreement was properly filed and executed. Does not appear to contain discriminatory language. No comments were filed, and staff does recommend approval of the agreement.
Great. Thanks very much. Well, all right. We've got three things that are going to take a little while from this point on, I presume. Hold on. Oh, yeah, we need a motion. That's right. Is there a motion? I would move the commission approve the interconnection agreement. Any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
John Smoltz, aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks, Commissioner Colbeck. All right, well, we skipped around a little bit, but I think we've got three major types of things to do that may all take a little bit of time. We do have the ARLEC Midco issue. We have the Orbitcom Verizon issue, and we've got the ETC. It was requested that the Verizon Orbitcom discussion go a little bit earlier in the agenda if possible, so it would be my intention to take that at this time. Anybody have a problem with that? Hearing none, then we'll go ahead and proceed with telecommunications item number 1 on the addendum. It's TC08-135. It's in the matter of a complaint filed by Orbitcom against Verizon Business Network Services regarding unpaid access charges. There are three questions for the commission today. The first is, shall it grant a motion to compel? The second is, shall the commission grant a motion to reset hearing dates? And third, shall the commission grant the request to supplement pre-filed direct testimony? At this time, it's most appropriate to hear comments on the first question. And Mr. Gerdes, you're ready to go?
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, my name is Dave Gerdes. I'm a lawyer from Pierre, and I represent Verizon Business in this docket. Tom Dixon, who is an in-house lawyer for Verizon Business, is on the phone. He is admitted pro hac vice. The papers were filed this morning with the commission. The order was signed late last week by Judge Brown of the Circuit Court. And so, Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd like to introduce Mr. Dixon, and he will provide the presentation on behalf of Verizon Business.
Thanks, Mr. Gerdes. Mr. Dixon, proceed.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. Commissioners, also on the phone with me this morning is Leslie Freet, who is our actual witness in this case and would be able to address any factual questions that may arise. I don't intend to call on her, but I wanted her to be available if there were factual questions that should arise. Also on the phone with me is Richard Shudbury, who is what we refer to as the line of business attorney that works with Verizon Business and is available, again, should there be any questions that perhaps I cannot handle. So I wanted to at least introduce you to the people on the phone and advise you. I also would ask that you be referring to what I referred to as our corrected motion to compel in an effort to get this filed before 5 o'clock on Thursday. Did not have some edits that were in it, so I filed a corrected version that was subsequently filed after that, and that's the document that replaced the earlier one. With that introduction, Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, we're dealing with a request to answer a data request number 48, which I have attached as Exhibit 1 to the motion to compel. And that exhibit requests specifically the call detail records that Orbicom has used to provide billing to Verizon in this particular case. We began asking for these records in February of 2008 and referred to the request for call detail records, and I have attached a number of exhibits in the form of emails that identify requests to obtain call detail records from Orbicom to provide to us the call detail that Orbicom had so we could determine how it was coming up with the billing statements it was providing to Verizon. Our requests have been very consistent. We have asked for call detail records, or the acronym you might see, CDRs, in those emails. But the long and the short of it, we've always asked for call detail records, or CDRs. And in question 48, once again, we referred to call detail records, but also said, or other call detail information sufficient to determine how Orbicom is assigning the jurisdiction of traffic that traverses its network from the Verizon long distance network. This issue is critical because depending on how the call detail records demonstrate the call originates and terminates, the call is assigned either an inter-INTER state rate or an intra-state rate, which would be for calls that originate and terminate in South Dakota. The intrastate rate, that is the rate that originates and terminates in South Dakota, is approximately 10 times higher than the interstate rate. We requested this information repeatedly, and it had never been provided to us. And so when Orbicom brought the complaint case against us, we then made a formal request in discovery, which is data request 048, for this very same information we'd asked for historically. I should point out that throughout the entire historical 18 months of dealing with this issue, at no time did Orbicom staff or people say we don't know what a CDR is or what call detail records are. And in fact, in reviewing its own tariff that it relies on, and particularly the section that I cited in the motion to compel, section 3.4, you will see that it talks about itself about call detail and refers specifically that when the company receives sufficient call detail to determine the jurisdiction of some or all originating terminating access of minutes, the company will use that call detail to render bills. So we were never aware that they didn't apparently understand what we were talking about. And in their objection, they stated our request was vague and that somehow we were not clear on what we were seeking. To make a long story short, and as you'll see in even the response, we exchanged emails, and it became readily apparent that we both knew what we were talking about. Why do we need call detail records? Well, call detail records are the best and most reliable evidence of the characteristics of a telephone call. And as Orbicom has been kind enough to provide in its response, in Exhibit 7, you can get a sense of what that information is. But what mostly is important is, for us, the originating and terminating, what's referred to as the NPA NXX. And included in that would be the last four digits of the what's called ANI, or automatic numbering indicator, just the normal 10-digit telephone number. These records provide the underlying data on which a carrier ordinarily determines the billing for a long-distance carrier such as Verizon, and then is the basis upon which they assign either the intrastate or interstate switched access rates. Orbicom has taken the position that we have all this data and that we can look to our own records to determine the very information that we're seeking from them. And first, that simply is not correct. Without the last four digits of the call detail records, the last four digits of the telephone numbers, we cannot compare anything because Orbicom is what's known as a UNIP provider of telephone service. That is, it does not have any of its own facilities, but rather like MCI Metro, uses the network of Quest to provide services. It does so as its own discovery is demonstrated through either an interconnection agreement or a commercial agreement such as the Quest Local Service Platform Agreement, which is referenced in this case. Under those agreements, Quest provides billing data to Orbicom and to MCI Metro and other competitive local exchange carriers, so they indeed can then provide billing information to the customers and determine how the calls will be rated, that is, interstate or intrastate. And these call detail records are the very documents or the very form of information, and I don't want to use documents because that sounds like paper, but it's the very information that's used by the competitive local exchange carrier, in this case Orbicom, to actually render a bill. Also, these CDRs are important for another reason. One issue in this case also has to do with whether Orbicom is properly billing Verizon for tandem switching service. And under the Commission's own rules and definitions of tandem switching service, it points out that a company may charge for tandem switching if indeed it provides that service. We have been pointing out in the testimony and in the information we provided that Verizon has a number of direct end office trunks from its long distance network to the Quest network. And that as a result, tandem switching would not be necessary when traffic is traversing those direct end office trunks. The CDRs will actually produce and have an identifier which indicates whether the call was, quote, tandem, end quote, routed. And with that, we can determine that we and Orbicom can determine whether or not the traffic actually went through the tandem switch. If it does not go through the tandem switch, it's our position that we should not be billed for tandem switching because it was not provided. And the Commission's own rules that not only define what tandem switching is but describe how to charge for it points out that it's a service when used. We believe that Orbicom's refusal to provide the call detail records are unreasonable for another reason. This case is not about what we can analyze. This case is about, as Orbicom's own tariff states, did it receive sufficient call detail to determine the jurisdiction of the call? If it received sufficient call detail under Section 3.4 of its tariff, it is obliged to use that call detail to then determine the jurisdiction of the call. It does not go to the two alternate methods that are discussed in Section 3.4, which are known as PIUs or percentage interstate usage. Those circumstances are only used when there is insufficient call detail. So this case isn't about what we can compare in our records, but rather is a case about what information did Orbicom receive and how did it use that call detail information, and was that information sufficient? In order for us to analyze that and address that in the defense of this proceeding, we need to see the very call detail information that Orbicom received. And that's why we've asked for it, and that's why we've been asking for it for 18 months. We've been advised by Orbicom that it does not retain this record past approximately 60 days, as I understand it. Again, there is some period of time. I'm not trying to hold the 60 days as a hard and fast period. But the bottom line, we've advised the historical data is no longer available. We've been asking for it for 18 months. It would seem under those circumstances, Orbicom should be retaining those records and instructing its billing agents or its own people to retain that type of data. But it has apparently failed to do so because it indicates it no longer has that data and is not available to us. In April of 2009, Orbicom changed its billing to us and other carriers. And it did a new form of billing, which it said would address our issues. Data request number 48 went specifically to that point. Rather than looking for historical data, we said, okay, let's take the current, the most current data that Orbicom is using to bill us, and look at 5 days of CDRs to determine, again, the call detail, and determine how those calls were assigned on a jurisdictional basis. Once again, in that data request, we use call data or the call data the call detail that was sufficient, again, using the exact language out of their tariff in Section 3.4. As indicated in the response, Orbitcom ultimately came back to us with a number of PDF versions of what looked like Excel spreadsheets. And they were a three-day sample. Orbitcom's choosing, not a five-day sample that we're requesting. They weren't the complete records for a day, but rather were extracts from those periods of time. And so they were not the complete daily records. And then, most importantly, to the extent we are going to try any comparison of their records against ours, they were missing the last four digits of the telephone numbers for the people that had made long-distance calls that were either originated or terminated on the Orbitcom network. Because Orbitcom receives its services through Quest as a UniP-type provider, and I use that in quotes, the effect is everything that we receive is identified to a Quest telephone number, not to an Orbitcom number. And so we have no way of knowing when the traffic comes in, whether it's Orbitcom traffic or Quest traffic. We simply know what's coming through a Quest switch. The call detail records, and particularly the 10-digit telephone numbers, would then allow us to know precisely which calls came through the Quest switch for Orbitcom that were ultimately originated or terminated on behalf of Verizon. Without the four digits, we can make no comparisons whatsoever. So this isn't a case about giving us the same detail in an Excel spreadsheet, because giving us the same information in an Excel spreadsheet without the last four digits makes the information something we cannot use, even in the Excel format. Now, to go to the last point that has been raised in both the response and that is, we just kind of keep asking for everything differently. We keep, every time we ask for something, we say it's insufficient. Every time we ask for something, we want more, whatever you want to say. I want to make something abundantly clear. We have always asked for customer detail records. When we received email correspondence between Ms. Moore and myself, and she's attached to much of it, we saw that they called customer detail records DUF, or daily usage fee. We also saw in response to Data Request 47, which was referenced in Data Request 48 and is indeed attached to the motion to compel, a reference to EMI records. And in that response, you can see that it appears Orbitcom knows exactly what we were talking about, and it appears that they know what it is. It's the daily usage fees, it's EMI records. So in our last effort to try and reach a resolution on the three-day sample as well as on the five-day request for Exhibit 48, I wrote an email using their words. I didn't call them call detail records because that seemed to be a fruitless effort. Rather, I talked about what Ms. Moore had referenced in her correspondence to me, the DUF or the daily usage fee, and I referred to the EMI format or the EMI records. We have never asked for a particular format. We have simply asked for the records as they're provided to Orbitcom. We have never asked them to provide more. We have asked for one thing, and it's never been given to us. As to the data request itself, we asked for 5 days. They provided three. We asked for all the data. They redacted portions. They removed the four digits, making it unusable, had they even put it in the Excel spreadsheet. Therefore, we didn't ask them to put it in Excel spreadsheet because it was of no value without the last four digits of the telephone number. And so, and in the final analysis, this type of information is exchanged between carriers all the time. Ms. Freed, who's on the phone as our witness, has actually verified the motion to compel. She has indicated that she receives call detail records probably on a weekly basis, and other carriers don't remove the last four digits of the telephone numbers. Other carriers have no problem identifying Verizon's traffic from all the other carriers that might be on the daily usage feed or the EMI records or the call detail records, whichever terminology you wish to use. Moreover, presumably, Orbitcom must be able to identify the Verizon traffic from those records and must be able to separate it from the other carriers, or I don't know how Orbitcom would be billing us traffic, because it would have to identify which is the Verizon traffic. So in the end analysis, our request has remained the same. We've tried to accommodate Orbitcom by reducing the amount of material we request We've tried to let them pick a five-day period in our data response, data request 48. We've tried to explain to them exactly what we want using the words that they have used when I've responded to their response to our data request. And all we've gotten is pushback, and we do not get the data that we've asked for, and we don't get complete data. So we're asking you to grant the motion to compel. And with that, we are asking that you direct Orbitcom to provide 5 days, as we requested in Data Request 48, 5 days of call detail records. We ask that that data not be edited except to provide only that data that's relevant to Verizon. We don't want AT&T's or Sprint's or any other IXC's data. We don't have any desire to look at that data. We're concerned only about our own. And then we ask that that be provided to us so that it's not been redacted or certainly to have the last 4 digits of the telephone numbers reviewed. And we hope that by looking at current data, we can get some indication of what is the nature of the traffic that traverses these two networks and whether, in fact, Orbitcom's allocation of 95% of the traffic in the beginning months to the intrastate time side at the higher rate of 10 times more than the interstate, and now and more recently at a 68% intrastate, the 10 times higher rate versus 32, when our records would indicate it's actually, from our perspective in general, not for Orbitcom, but in the state of South Dakota, for all the carriers that we deal with, our average traffic runs closer to the high 70s and 80% intrastate and 20% or thereabout interstate, 20 to 23%. You can see there's a significant difference in what our records indicate generally and that which we've asked for from Orbitcom and how they're billing us. The call detail records are the documents that can answer the question clearly and unequivocally, at least for the period of time it's provided to us. And then perhaps we can go back for the amount of the months that have been disputed and extract or extrapolate or come up with a surrogate method of determining what the interstate and intrastate traffic mix was. And so with that, Mr. Chairman, I have, and Commissioners, that summarizes our corrected motion to compel, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Dixon. Mr. Gerdes, any other comments before we move on?
I have none.
Okay, great. Thanks very much. This time we'll hear from Orbitcom. Ms. Moore?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Commissioners and staff, opposing counsel, Meredith Moore appearing on behalf of Orbitcom this morning. This is a rather unusual motion to compel. Typically, when one looks at a motion to compel, one is faced with the prospect of one party refusing to produce information in conformance with a particular request. In this particular instance, what has happened is that Orbitcom has, in fact, produced a significant amount of information, over several hundred pages of call detail records and information that pertains to well in excess of 200,000 calls. What we've got here, therefore, is essentially a claim by Verizon that what has been produced is insufficient or isn't good enough. There have been repeated references made to this 18-month period over which Verizon made these requests and what is a purported misunderstanding on Orbitcom's part as to what constitutes a CDR document. And I would submit to the Commission that there's never been a misunderstanding on the part of Orbitcom as to what constitutes a CDR or what constitutes the type of information which Verizon claims it needs in order to analyze its claim. What it is, however, is a specific statement that has been made by Orbitcom that it does not have the records in the format as requested by Verizon, and a further specific statement made that disclosing the specific ANIs that have been requested is a disclosure of CPNI, is a disclosure of confidential information, is a disclosure that Orbitcom simply has not been able to either make or isn't willing to make under the circumstances. When Discovery Request 48 was initially made in July of this year, Orbitcom did in fact propound an objection to that discovery request. And one of those objections was vagueness. And that was because there was no definition provided of a CDR record or of call detail information, which is what the request essentially asked for, either CDRs or other call detail information which would allow Orbitcom to correctly jurisdictionalize the traffic or to determine whether Orbitcom correctly jurisdictionalized the traffic. This is exactly why Orbitcom produced what it did in response to that request, because it allows that determination. And what happened thereafter was essentially Verizon making the claim that that information isn't good enough. And that's the penultimate problem with the discovery request with which we're dealing here today, is that the way in which it was drafted, the information that has been requested ultimately allows Verizon to continue to make that determination that the information that isn't provided isn't good enough. And a lot of that, I believe, goes to what is a fundamental misunderstanding of the information that Orbitcom provided and the information that's ultimately necessary in order to determine whether Orbitcom did, in fact, properly bill Verizon over the period that's involved in our current dispute. And I think what we go back to here is ultimately where we started. And there was a comment, I believe, made that we believe the CDR is the same thing as the DUF or the daily usage fee, or we believed it was the same thing as an EMI. That's not correct. Orbitcom has always believed that a CDR is, in fact, the call detail information, and the call detail record is ultimately what is created from that underlying daily usage feed. If you look at Orbitcom's brief, there's an explanation, if you will, of the process by which those call detail records, and those call detail records were produced to Verizon, were actually created. And what happens there is you have this daily usage feed, which Orbitcom gets from the carrier through which it's interconnected, which is another LAC. And that daily usage feed is raw data, which without running it through a billing system, without putting it into context, simply is never going to give the information that's necessary in order to determine whether a call has been properly jurisdictionalized and whether ultimately that bill is correct. And so what happens is when you look at that daily usage feed and you look at the 210-plus fields that that contains, the billing system extracts from that daily usage feed the requisite fields in order to comprise the bill. Then what happens is the billing system of, in this case, Orbitcom, provides the specific rating information. That's what ultimately produces the call detail record, and that's exactly what was produced to Verizon on August 5th of this year, were multiple documents detailing that fact. Now, the crux of the dispute really seems to come down to, are the ANIs necessary in order for Verizon to determine the accuracy of Orbitcom's billing? And I would submit to you that that's not an entirely correct statement either. Verizon's argument seems to be that the ANI is necessary because it is the only way that will allow it to distinguish an Orbitcom customer from a Quest customer or someone else for that matter. That's not correct. What that presumes, essentially, is that the ANI is in the LURG, and I think you'll see that in Verizon's corrected motion to compel. What they're saying there is they need the ANI, then they can look to the LURG, then they can determine whether that calls an Orbitcom customer or a Quest customer or someone else for whom Verizon shouldn't receive a bill. But the ANI isn't in the LURG. That information actually comes from the SS7 information, which Verizon already has. The OCN, which is used to determine that caller, is actually in that information. And if one looks at some of Verizon's discovery requests in this particular case, and at some of the information that Verizon has produced, their own information specifically indicates that Verizon collects SS7-based call records. That's what ultimately allows them to match to terminating call records and to make a determination as to the jurisdiction of the call and to whether it's properly been billed. So the request that Verizon is ultimately making here today is one that still isn't going to give them the requisite information. And that's why we ultimately go back to the fact that the information that Orbitcom has produced in response to Verizon's specific data request here, that was the 3 days of information for June of 2009, several hundred pages of call detail information, and what was essentially discussed with Verizon prior to its production is more than sufficient to allow Verizon to make a determination as to whether the calls were properly jurisdictionalized. And it was after Verizon indicated that that information wasn't sufficient that essentially we got this changing, evolving request for additional information or new information, all of which the entirety of that time and the entirety of the 18th month period was explained to Verizon. Orbitcom can't produce that information in the requested format. It doesn't exist there. And what we produced in August of this year, which are those call detail records, that's not information that Orbitcom has in its ordinary course either. That was information that it took significant hours, significant manpower in order to produce to Verizon. So ultimately what we are looking at here is that Orbitcom has more than produced adequate information to allow Verizon to make its ultimate determination. And allowing or granting the motion to compel here ultimately simply allows delay of the hearing that's been scheduled now for quite some time, over which there's a significant dispute of money which has not been paid to Orbitcom now since 2008. And allowing a delay in order to require more information for which there still hasn't been a specific definitional parameter set only results likely in further delay and potentially even being back before this commission again with the claim that, again, what was produced, if anything, wasn't good enough. Ultimately, there's a reason why parties have hearings, and it's to resolve disputes. Orbitcom bears the burden of proof in this particular matter. Orbitcom has produced information to date through testimony, through the information which was given to Verizon in August of this year, which supports the bills that were submitted to Verizon and which were not paid, which supports the billing of the particular rate applied, which supports the PIU or the jurisdictionalization of the traffic that was billed to Verizon. And Orbitcom has the burden of proving that to the commission at the time of the hearing. If Verizon would like to rebut that, indicate that the evidence isn't sufficient to establish Orbitcom's claim, that's certainly within their rights. That's certainly something which one would expect they would do at the time of the hearing. But it comes down to a sufficiency of the evidence type of argument, not a lack of evidence, nor any sort of intent on the part of Orbitcom to be evasive or not to produce the requisite information. To the contrary, if anything, we have produced more than what we can produce in this situation, and we have simply drawn the line at producing information which we either don't have or which can in no way be produced because it is information for other carriers, it's customer information, it's CPNI, which simply cannot be adequately protected. So therefore, what I would submit to this commission is that we've produced everything that Verizon needs. Verizon has its own records, which its own discovery responses will support. It can make this analysis. It can make this comparison. It can make the determination that ultimately the information is, in fact, correct. What they have in front of them is the NPA NXX. That's been produced. That's what's ultimately needed to jurisdictionalize the calls here, and that's what we've done. So we would respectfully submit that granting the motion to compel here will only delay this hearing for an indefinite period of time, cause significant prejudice to my client who's already not being paid and has not been paid for months and over a year, and it simply does not serve the ultimate ends of justice in this particular case. So we would request that the motion be denied. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Moore. Staff, comments? I was going to allow him rebuttal after staff made its comments. He may want to rebut what you say as well.
This is Karen Kramer from staff, and I can appreciate Orbitcom's concern about they don't have this data in that form. It appears, though, that they can get it. I'm also concerned with their argument that, well, you know, Verizon can just look to their own records, because it's true, as they said, the burden really is on Orbitcom here, and discovery is more open, and the purpose of which is to allow both parties to present a case to the commission. I don't pretend to understand how the network works and how all this works, but it does appear they do have that information. So, and they have produced 3 days' worth, and I'm not entirely clear if it's complete 3 days or pretty much 3 days, but really, if we're just looking at 5 days, we're not that far removed from that much more information. Put in a weekend, put, you know, I think there was a concern that there were no weekend days there. It just seems like they could produce this information, because I keep coming back to Verizon's argument where they claim, and I think we have to hold them to their word at that, that without those four digits, they simply cannot make a comparison. And I think they do need that information to go forward with this case. So staff would recommend granting the motion to compel, and maybe with some limits, maybe the parties can come up with some limitations on that. I've talked to Ms. Forney as to another hearing date, if this cannot be produced quickly enough and if they need to file more testimony. And she tells me that with a one-day hearing, that can easily be dropped into, right now we're set for September 9. There is time available in later September. They probably will need into October, I would think. But she said there's plenty of one-day hearings if the parties still believe this is a one-day hearing. And so while it might push it back another month or 6 weeks, we're not looking at like February or March or anything like that for a hearing date.
Mr. Dixon, opportunity for rebuttal?
I'll be very brief. Ms. Kramer stated much of what I would have said in response to Ms. Moore, in which I have somewhat indicated in the corrected motion to compel. Ms. Moore keeps talking about this as being CP&I, and somehow that's cloaked in such a veil of secrecy that no one should see it. But clearly, the federal statute that addresses this issue, 47, U.S.C. 222, both sections B, that is little b and d, clearly contemplate and, in fact, require that CP&I be exchanged between carriers for the purpose of billing, collecting information for billing purposes, et cetera. We also have a confidentiality agreement that we entered into between us at the outset of discovery and when we did our procedural schedule. So to suggest that because this is CP&I, it can't be produced, that is, the full telephone number, to suggest that we don't have appropriate confidentiality or that it's confidential information and shouldn't be produced is to ignore the confidentiality agreement we've provided. We have provided Orbitcom confidential information under the agreement, and we have no problem doing that. We are confident Orbitcom can provide us confidential information, and we'll treat it appropriately under the agreement. Finally, with respect to what Ms. Moore said in general, we have tried to craft the request in a way that Orbitcom would clearly understand it. It's clear just listening to Ms. Moore, as she stated, we know what they want. And the answer is very clear then, produce it. You know, then we won't go through these questions and, you know, is it the CDRs that are produced, the daily usage fees through the EMI records, et cetera. You know what we're looking for. You know what we're talking about. Produce it. And so I would simply say the motion to compel should be granted. We would ask that the company be directed, that is Orbitcom, be directed to produce this information to us forthwith in accordance with our confidentiality agreement that produces that, that protects that information, and that the remainder of the request and the motion compelled be granted so that we have time to analyze that information and potentially update our testimony so that we can address whatever we determine through the information we requested. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner.
Thank you. Well, let's start with questions for Mr. Dixon then. Any questions? You know, Mr. Dixon, Mr. Johnson here, at some point you had said, well, you know, you got to throw us in a weekend today. I'm a little concerned because as I look at the original discovery request, it doesn't say that. It just says a five-day sample. Can you say anything that would lead me to believe that Verizon should be entitled to a weekend a day as part of its five?
Mr. Chairman, we're perfectly willing to stand on the data request as written. The discussions about a Saturday or Sunday came when 3 days of data was produced, not five. 3 days of partial data was produced, not the full records, and also when the data was redacted so that we didn't have the four telephone numbers. We suggested the Saturday or Sunday would be appropriate because calling patterns from our records tend to be different on weekends. But we're not trying to expand our data request. We'll live with the words that it says. If Orbicom doesn't want to do Saturdays or Sundays for some reason, that's up to them. But we thought that when we looked at the 3 days of data, that a Saturday or Sunday would also be a day that would indicate weekend traffic as opposed to weekday traffic. But I'm not asking for the data request to be modified in any fashion. I believe weekend traffic is relevant. If Orbicom doesn't, we'll deal with what they provide in response to our data request.
Okay, thanks, Mr. Dixon. And then Ms. Moore and her client indicate that there's some confusion on Verizon's part about looking to the LURG, being able to use that ANI information to look to the LURG. Help me understand better why you do need the ANI information to determine whether it's Quest or whether it's Orbicom traffic. And you're not expecting to get the answers to that through the LURG, are you?
That's not what I'm. You know, I have to confess, I have my witness on the phone, and if appropriate, we can direct those. Those are factual questions, Mr. Chairman. I can explain why we need the four digits to the extent we need to elaborate on where that information is in the LURG, et cetera. I can have Ms. Freet answer that question if that's appropriate. But let me state generally, the tenfold digits are needed because Orbicom is, as I said, a UNIP provider. And all the telephone numbers assigned to its end users are assigned in the industry databases or the LURG. Now, what that means is that those telephone numbers are identified with Quest end offices and are assigned to Quest switches. Those numbers aren't unique to Orbicom. So the 10 digits then allow us to identify what's Orbicom traffic from any other Quest end-user traffic. There's no publicly available information that allows Verizon as an inter-exchange carrier to distinguish between the telephone numbers associated with Orbicom and those of any other end-user served by Quest. And all the traffic that originates in that Quest end office that is routed to Verizon's long-distance network is indistinguishable to us, contrary to what Ms. Moore has been stating. I know she cited and attached some testimony from Mr. Munzel that was provided in a case years ago involving an interconnection agreement between, and these are critical differences, a facility-based CLEC and Verizon as an ILEC. This also occurred prior to the merger of MCI with Verizon. Mr. Munzel has testimony that cited and referenced does not discuss in any fashion the capability of Verizon's long-distance network. Those issues are totally simply different, and the fact that it was a facilities-based CLEC that was involved in the case that Mr. Munzel was testifying is a significant difference. We can only represent to you accurately, and Ms. Freed, again, has already verified this data in our motion, that without those four digits, we cannot identify Orbicom's traffic, pure and simple. And that's the long and the short of it, Mr. Chairman.
Well, thanks, Mr. Dixon, and my intention wasn't to put you in a tight spot with fact-based questions. I'm just trying to determine the likelihood of this information, you know, leading to something admissible. You know, we got two parties. One says ANI is not helpful, and you all say that it's absolutely necessary. The commission's probably going to have to make a determination about what they think on that front. So, other questions for Mr. Dixon? Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Dixon? Okay, with that, we'll turn toward questions for Orbicom. Ms. Moore? Commissioner, go ahead.
Yes, Ms. Moore, does the CDR contain the KIC code of the carrier? If you just have the seven digits, do you know that?
I believe it does, Commissioner. And what's been produced here is the NTA NXX information and all of the other fields from that daily usage feed that Verizon has talked about, with the exception of the last four digits. So ultimately, everything there that's needed to determine the ultimate jurisdiction of the call was in the records that were originally produced to Verizon. And I think one of the primary disputes that we've had is that the process which Verizon has used to describe how this information is in fact produced is, they talk about it as being a simple one, and that's not the case, because ultimately what my client gets from Quest is information as it relates not only to Orbicom customers, but also customers for over 60 other IXCs. So it's not something that's particularly easy to ultimately draw out. But what we produced in August would have been all of the requisite billing information, the NPA, the NXX, and the KIC code, which the relevant KIC codes in this particular case are 555 or 222, and if one looks at the documents produced, one would find that there.
Okay, so you're saying that if the CDR has a KIC code of 555 or 222, that would demonstrate that it's Orbicom traffic, correct?
Correct.
Okay, so then if you've got in the CDR, you've got the NPA NXX, since we only have one NPA in South Dakota, if it's a 605 to a 605, that would be a given that it's an interstate call, correct?
I apologize.
Am I understanding that correctly?
I had a buzzing at that point. Could you repeat your question, please?
Yeah. If you've got the KIC code, which would be 555 or 222 in the CDR, correct?
Yes.
Then you've got the 605, the NPA, and the NXX in the CDR also.
Yes.
Since South Dakota only has one NPA, it should be relatively easy from that CDR to determine if it's interstate call.
Correct.
Is that the information you're sending them? Is all of that information in that CDR?
That is the information that we provided in August, Commissioner. We provided the KIC code, the NPA, the NXX, all of the relevant fields that are used for billing that are ultimately pulled out of that daily usage fee, which my client receives from, in this case, Quest. The only thing that wasn't in there would have been the last four digits of the phone number, or the last four digits of the ANI, as Verizon has described. So we would submit that they have everything in what has already been produced in order to look at that, and then they can look to their own SS7 information as well.
Okay, and then I'm a little confused on your exhibit number 7, that's an AMI, correct?
Exhibit number 7 is an EMI, correct.
Okay, and then your exhibit number 8 is a CDR.
Correct.
Okay, what is it that you sent them? Did you send them exhibit 7 or did you send them exhibit 8?
We didn't send them either one of those. Those were produced to you for illustrative purposes only, simply to show the difference between the two.
Okay.
What we sent to them, we did not send to the commission because of the sheer size of the documents. We originally, I believe, sent 9 different emails to Verizon, many of which were between 60 and 80 pages of data per email. So we didn't submit those to the commission simply because it was so voluminous. The exhibits attached to the affidavit of counsel in support of our opposition to the motion to compel were provided for illustrative purposes to show the difference between what an EMI record presents and what a CDR record presents, so that you would be able to see the differences between the two and how the CDR record, which we ultimately produced, would provide the needed information.
Okay.
I apologize. I should have clarified that better in my document.
That's okay. Did the information that you sent them look more like Exhibit 8 then? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. You sent them the zeros and ones and not necessarily the Excel format.
We did not send the Excel format. When it became an issue that we provided it in PDF rather than Excel, we offered to provide that in Excel. However, as Mr. Dixon explained, ultimately the primary dispute was over the fact that the last four digits were not produced, much less than the actual format itself.
Okay. But the CDR record that you sent them was complete except for the last four digits of the called and the calling number, correct?
That is correct, Commissioner. And ultimately, if you were to look at Exhibit 8, I think a better way that I should have explained this to you was that if you look at the page 1, that would have been page 1 of the numerous documents that we provided to Verizon in August in response to that specific data request. And what we did there is we provided the 3 days for the complete records, the last four digits of the phone number, but with all of that other information that would be produced on Exhibit 8 in response to the motion to compel. We didn't provide a weekend. We offered to provide a weekend if Verizon wanted one. However, we did not do so simply because Orbitcom is a provider of phone service to small businesses, and its weekend traffic is about 10% of what the weekday traffic is, so we didn't think that'd be representative. If we need to produce that, they can produce that, and it's already been offered.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I'm sorry to interrupt, sir, but I heard two errors, and I want to understand them, at least what I thought were errors, and I just want to ensure that Ms. Moore meant what she said. May I inquire just quickly?
Yes, go ahead, Mr. Dixon.
When asked by the commissioner if the 555 and the 222 kick codes would identify Orbitcom, Ms. Moore indicated that would do that. Those are the kick codes of Verizon. Those aren't the Orbitcom kick codes. Those are the two networks that Verizon operates and the two kick codes. And so I believe Ms. Moore misspoke to suggest those are the Orbitcom kick codes, and I thought that's what her answer indicated. So I just wanted to clarify that.
Ms. Moore?
And if that's what I said, I apologize. That wasn't what I intended to say. What I intended to say was that those are, in fact, the kick codes for Verizon, and where one can get the OCN information for Orbitcom is from the SS7 information, and that would have also been provided in the information that was produced in August. So if I left that impression, I apologize. What I should have said there was those are Verizon kick codes.
Thank you. The other issue is, and again, this may be just because we're working orally, I'm looking at the actual motion and exhibit numbers, and it appeared to me that again, the way it was stated, that I was confused which we received and which we didn't receive or what was similar. But on the document that actually is in front of me, Exhibit A is the one that the commissioner referred to as having ones and zeros, et cetera. We did not get that, and so that's clear, and I think Ms. Moore said we didn't actually get either. But what we got was more like the spreadsheet in the PDF, but it was in a PDF format. So I wanted just to clarify, we did not get either specifically, as she's indicated, but what we received was more like what is identified in the motion as Exhibit the exhibit that has the lengthy spreadsheet. But again, the last four digits are missing. And as the chairman indicates, we believe that's a decision the commission will have to make as to how relevant that is.
Ms. Moore, do you dispute any of that?
Well, if I heard Mr. Dixon correctly, I think he was referring to Exhibit A to his own motion. And if I understood Commissioner Kolbeck's question correctly, I thought he was referring to Exhibit 8 or the number 8. To Orbitcom's response, and so what I was comparing there was to Exhibit 8, not to Exhibit the letter A.
Well, I was also talking about Exhibit 8, but that's what I'm trying to make clear, Mr. Chairman and Commissioners. Exhibit 8 is the one that has the ones and zeros. We did not get that. And the exhibit that's at least on the document that was sent to me late yesterday, Exhibit 7 is the one that's a spreadsheet, and that's all I'm trying to clarify, which is more like what we received.
Mr. Dixon, your description of the exhibits matches with what we're looking at. Ms. Moore, do you dispute that Exhibit 7 is more like what Verizon got?
And I apologize. I'm pulling those up to make sure I'm talking about the right one of me.
No problem. Take your time. Ms. Moore, do you mind if Commissioner Kolbeck asks Mr. Dixon a question while you're pulling that up?
Not at all.
Okay, go ahead, Commissioner.
Yes, Mr. Dixon, if the format in Exhibit 7 of Ms. Moore's Orbitcom testimony is more like you got, you received, is the originating, is the originating NPA and the terminating NPA NXX and the KIC on the information that you received?
Yes.
It is.
That's what I see. What's missing are the last four digits so we can actually figure out which of these calls came from Orbitcom. There are other carriers that would have the same KICs, would have the same NPA NXX, and it wouldn't be Orbitcom traffic. It would be Quest traffic. It could be another carrier's traffic.
I agree with that. But if you had the Orbitcom KIC, you would know that it's Orbitcom traffic because we only have one NPA in the state of South Dakota.
I understand that, Mr. Commissioner. And if all of that were true, then we wouldn't be here. We would have already done all this. I mean, we've been trying to get these for 18 months. If we could have gotten it, we would have done it. If we had it in our own system, we would have done it. But the fact is, we cannot do it. And I have a factual witness who can address that issue specifically and why, you know, we raised this very point that we need the four last four digits of the telephone number. And I'd be happy to have her speak to your question if you'd like.
Does your template have the Verizon KIC or the Orbitcom KIC? Because I'm having a little, having a little trouble. If it's got the Orbitcom KIC, that's the only way it's going to route correctly through a switch.
I'm looking at what was provided to us, the first page. The only KICs on there that I see under the category KIC, and if you look at Exhibit 7, you'll see the third column, the top KIC. That's a 555 KIC. That's a Verizon KIC. That's
yes.
Not Orbitcom.
I understand that, but this is just a representation of what you got, and the actual information that you got, was it Orbitcom's KIC on there, or was it Verizon's KIC on there?
That's what I'm saying. It was the Verizon KIC was on there. But your representation looks remarkably similar to what I have.
Okay.
It does not have the Orbitcom KIC.
Okay. Then I would tend to agree with you that you would need the seven digits.
The whole 10-digit.
If you did not receive the Orbitcom KIC in your information, then I would agree with you that you would need
right.
The seven
and I'll
digits.
Be happy to put Ms. Freed on the stand under oath.
Okay.
So state that. I'm an attorney, and as I said, I have a factual witness to address those type of questions.
Okay. Ms. Moore, have you figured out the answer to Mr. Johnson's question?
Well, in looking at what we produced in August to Verizon, would have been more similar to Exhibit 8, which was that CDR record, what we ultimately used there. And so, therefore, with what we produced in August, that would contain the KIC information, it contains the OCN information for Orbitcom, because what we're looking at here, there's a distinction between the line distance plus the KIC code, and what Orbitcom has is the OCN number. And so that would have been produced in a similar format to what we produced as an example of that CDR record. Is Exhibit 8. So that, I believe, would have been in what we produced, and I appreciate you don't have this in front of you, but there were a number of columns in the information that we produced in that PDF format, and one of those particular columns contained the Orbitcom OCN. It would actually be the question.
Okay, do we have other questions for any of the parties? If not, we would move toward comments and action. I don't know. I guess I'll open up a little conversation with my colleagues to see if they disagree with me on anything. The argument advanced by Orbitcom with regard to CPNI, I don't find too convincing because of the arguments made by Verizon regarding the federal code and the confidentiality agreement. I would tell you I don't know if the ANIs are needed or not, but I don't know for certainty, but I would tell you if I'm on the fence, I sort of feel like we should err on the side of getting Verizon what it says it needs to prepare its case. Are there other issues? And I don't know. I think we've heard from Verizon that they want either 3 days with a weekend or 5 days in general. So my thought would be that we could ask Orbitcom to provide that. But I don't know. What issues am I missing or what issues are out there to discuss? Commissioners Hansen and Colbeck?
Commissioner Johnson?
Yes, go ahead.
I agree with the statements that you've made, and for similar reasons. I also believe that if our staff is going to, from our standpoint, we have really more than two parties here. To an extent, we have four, but really our staff needs to be confident that they have the information that they need in order to examine and present information to us from the standpoint of the consumers. I value that information, and I think that if they believe they need it, then certainly I would think that Verizon would need it as well.
As far as the five-day sample, I think the Verizon's request is a five-day sample that demonstrates that Orbitcom correctly determined the jurisdiction. So I think it would be up to Orbitcom to choose the 5 days. I think that's what the data request says. They've only got three. I do believe that it should only be edited to what is relevant. And I do believe that all they need is a call record. All they need is a CDR with all 10 digits, and then they can tell who they're picked to. Because if the pick is not coming through, if Orbicom's pick is not on the CDR that they're supplying, I don't feel that there's any other way that they can tell who's that is subscribed to.
Forgive me, I'm having a little bit of a challenge hearing Commissioner Colbeck.
Oh, sorry. I'll get a little closer here.
Thank you.
First of all, I think that the 5 days sample should be determined by Orbitcom, because I think the data request says that it demonstrates that Orbitcom correctly determined the jurisdiction of the calls. So it just says a 5 day sample. And then second, I do feel that Verizon requested that it be edited to only what's relevant. And what I feel is relevant is a CDR with the KIC code, Orbitcom's KIC code, or a CDR with all 10 digits. Because if you don't have the KIC code for Orbitcom or the all 10 digits, you can't tell who that customer is going to terminate over. So I guess, do we make that, Ms. Moore, would there be, and this is just a simple question, is it easier for Orbitcom to supply a KIC code in your CDR, or is it easier to supply all 10 digits? Because we need one or the other.
I think it'd be easier to supply the KIC code, Commissioner, and I think that's something that we could likely do within a couple of days.
This is Leslie, and I know I'm probably not supposed to talk, but Orbitcom doesn't have a KIC code, for the record. Only long-distance carriers have KIC codes, so they're not going to be able to supply a KIC code.
Okay, that was difficult to hear, so I'm going to ask you to speak up and say that one more time.
Orbitcom does not have a KIC code. Only long-distance carriers have a KIC code, so they're not going to be able to supply a KIC code. They don't have one. And their OCN on the call detail record is going to be quite...
We're going to go ahead and just stop you. We're having a real hard time hearing you. I don't want to put words in your mouth, so I'm going to... say, I think your main point, and you need to tell us if you're wrong. What you're saying is that Orbitcom does not have a KIC code because only long-distance carriers have a KIC code.
Right.
And so the 10-digit, I mean, the inclusion of the ANI is necessary.
Yes, it is. And they could provide an OCN, but the OCN is Quest because Quest owns these phone numbers, and they're selling them to Orbitcom. So we need the 10-digit phone number to do our analysis.
And Mr. Commissioner, if I can respond to that, Ms. Fried is correct. We don't have a KIC code, but we do have the OCN number. We do have one. It's 8080, and that was what was originally produced. Well, so if that's what the commission is looking for the 5 days, that's something we can produce.
Well, there won't be any call.
Hold on. Ms. Moore's got the floor. Go ahead, Ms. Moore. Proceed.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Commissioner. What we provided in August was the OCN, which identified Orbicom. That number is 8080. It's not Quest. And the Orbicom OCN was specifically identified in one of the columns. And so if what the commission is looking for is for us to produce the 5-day sample as opposed to the 3-day sample which has been produced, we can do that by producing the OCN for those additional 2 days.
Okay, and now thanks, Ms. Moore. Now a question for Horizon. I'm looking on Exhibit 7, and in the column almost in the very middle, I'm seeing an originating OCN, and then on a column that's sixth from the right, I'm seeing a terminating OCN. The question to Verizon is, in what way is this information insufficient for you to determine jurisdictionally, you know, what's appropriate?
Mr. Chairman, I would like my factual witness, Ms. Freet, who was talking earlier, to respond to your question.
We're willing to allow a little bit of liberality as long as neither staff nor Orbicom objects. I'm rather reticent to allow factual witnesses in this sort of just argument setting, but if nobody else objects, I'm okay with it.
Mr. Commissioner, this is Meredith Moore. I do have to interpose an objection. I can understand why the commission needs to know some of this information, but at the same time, I'll freely admit I'm not the technical expert, nor am I the person that knows the most about these bills. And if I had been aware that we were essentially going to be offering testimony, I would also have had someone on the call to make any representations, because my fear at this point is that what comments are offered by Verizon I may or may not be able to adequately rebut. So I would have to interpose an objection.
Fair enough, Ms. Moore. Mr. Dixon, I don't think I have much of a choice other than to tell you anything you can tell us is fine, but we're not really ready to go much deeper than that.
Well, I will simply advise you, my witness and our expert person who deals with this data all the time, works with 500 carriers across the country, has indicated the data that we received, regardless of what's on it, was insufficient for us to be able to identify Orbicom traffic. And as I said, we wouldn't go through this effort if indeed we could. And as was pointed out, and I didn't expect Ms. Freet to point it out to you, I was going to do it at the appropriate time. IXCs are the only entities that have a KIC code, and our records have no data about a UNIP CLEC such as Orbicom, either our SS7 records or anything else. So, and the reason I had a factual witness is, again, we had a verified motion, and I anticipated factual questions which I, as an attorney, cannot answer and shouldn't, frankly, because it's not part of the sworn record. But the long and the short of it is that we don't have the information on the equivalent to Exhibit 7 that is sufficient to identify Orbicom, period. And we need the last 4 digits. That will do it, and then we can move on.
Okay, well, let's return to a little bit of formality here. I'll go ahead and make a motion for discussion's sake, and then commissioners can discuss the motion. I move that the commission will approve the motion to compel, to the extent that it relates to the provision of ANI information, 5 days worth of data, and that data must be transmitted in Excel or Access or some other format that's easily manipulated. I'll start with that, and certainly if there are suggestions or corrections to the motion by commissioners or advisors, I'm all ears. Discussion on the motion.
Mr. Chairman, are we confident that the ANI information will provide? Is that, I'm a little bit confused, is that providing the 10-digit information?
Commissioner, I'm certain this is a problem on our end because now you're the second person that's had a lot of breaking up. Leslie Freet was as well. Can you say it one more time and we'll try to do something on our end to have you come through a little more clearly?
I am concerned with the 10-digit information and the ability for that to be provided will the ANI information that you have included secure that, provide that information?
Is the question whether or not the provision of the 10 digits can be done securely in a way not to violate confidentiality?
I just want to be certain that I believe the 10-digit information is necessary.
Yes.
And I want to be certain that that is part of the motion. Is that included in the ANI information?
A great clarification question. Sorry, I didn't get it the first time. Yes, Commissioner, my intention would be that the ANI, the last four digits of the 10, would after that provided, would give Verizon access to the full 10-digit telephone number.
Thank you.
Other discussion or questions on the pending motion?
I think one more. Verizon requested the hearing date of September 9th be vacated. Would you like that to put that in your motion?
Well, let's figure out what we do with this motion, and then we can, you know, because if from a practical standpoint, if this motion is defeated, then we probably don't need to, you know, two and three get kind of answered more quickly.
I think you mentioned it, but edited the response to the data request coming from Orbitcom should be edited to be what only is relevant. Orbitcom should not be compelled to provide anything other than the 10 digits and what is relevant to the CDR record, correct?
Yeah, at this point, the motion just calls for the, you know, has some instruction for format, some instruction for his duration, and instruction that it must include the ANI. Everything else, the motion is silent on.
That sounds like a good motion to me.
Other questions or comments? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. And then Commissioner Colbeck is right. We do have two further questions related to this area. One is, shall the commission grant the motion to reset the hearing dates? I'll just ask, given the commission's action on the first question, does anyone object to resetting the hearing dates?
Mr. Commissioner, this is Meredith Moore. My client would object to resetting the hearing dates. Based on what the commission has compelled this morning, I believe that we can produce the requisite information by the end of the week. Additionally, just by way of background explanation for the commission, last Friday, Orbitcom received a third set of discovery requests from Verizon. And there was no request for delay at that point in time with those requests. So I think we're already operating under a time frame where we can produce all of the information and keep that hearing date, and that's ultimately what's necessary here.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Moore. Mr. Dixon, given the fact that there's still information being shared between the parties, why would the commission reset the hearing dates?
Well, once we receive the additional information, and particularly the information we've been requesting with regard to the four digits, it may necessitate Ms. Freet supplementing her testimony. You will note that we received the August 5th data on the afternoon, almost the evening of the 5th, and our testimony was due on the 7th. And so in the testimony, Ms. Freet indicated that once she received the data that we were requesting, she would then request permission to supplement. We don't know at this point until we receive the data how long it will take to review it and then whether or not it will be necessary to supplement it. I'm not requesting the hearing be vacated for any particular reason other than the very reasons we've stated. We have operated under the schedule. We've filed our testimony as best we could. We have brought a motion to compel under the terms of our stipulation on procedure during the August, last meeting in August that we could bring it. Your next meeting is the day before the hearing. It seems under the circumstances, given the fact that we have tried to fully comply with the process, that at this point in time, giving us this time to try and review, supplement, and I suspect Orbitcom may want to respond to our supplemental response testimony, that trying to have the hearing on September 9th is going to be unreasonable. I don't know if it'll give staff time to review the data. I have no idea, and that's a separate issue. But we've stayed within the schedule.
Staff, your comments?
And somewhat understand Mr. Dixon's point. Until you see it, I don't. It's hard to say, and how long it takes to produce is always a question. Is this something we could defer and do an ad hoc if once the information is produced, and then that'll give everyone a better idea of how long they need to respond to it, and if Ms. Moore's client then wants to respond back, you know, we could either agree to a new procedural schedule that wouldn't require commission approval. I don't know. I just, at this point, I'd prefer to defer those questions until we see how quickly it's produced and what it is.
Mr. Chairman.
Hold on, Mr. Dixon. Sure. Well, you go ahead and respond, and then we'll take your questions.
I guess, you know, we're taking that back, that they can produce what was objected to as burdensome by Friday. But if they make that, we'll make our effort to review it immediately. I should point out, and I didn't bring this up before the hearing because I'm not looking for any sympathy. I was actually driving from Seattle for the last day and a half nonstop and cut out a vacation day I was supposed to be with my grandkids to do this case, to do that on this date so we could stay within the commission schedule. I'm not here to try and delay this case. I'm looking for a fair and complete opportunity to review the facts in this case and to determine whether or not Orbitcom properly applied the call detail. If we make that determination from this information, we still have the issue of all of apparently what we requested for 18 months is missing. So somehow we're going to have to take that data and use it as a surrogate or extrapolate from it, which I am confident will be a significant issue for even Orbitcom to whether they'll allow us to try and figure out how to go back the period of time that this issue has been in dispute. So I would recommend that the hearing be vacated now, but I certainly can agree to staff's approach that we defer it. My concern is I got to bring a witness in, and I have to fly in for the hearing in advance. Your next meeting is the 8th, and I know Ms. Kramer was talking about an ad hoc meeting. I just would like to have enough time to be able to fly into the South Dakota, properly prepare, and be ready to go with the hearing, whenever it is.
Commissioner, questions? Ms. Kramer, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I apologize, Mr. Chairman. This is Meredith Moore. May I make one brief comment, please?
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I would concur with staff's comments at this point in time, given the difficulty in getting hearing dates and planning, that we simply keep this. Orbitcom will do its best to produce that information as quickly as it possibly can to allow Verizon to evaluate it. And it's been represented to me in the past that once Verizon has those four digits, this is a very simple inquiry. So I would simply ask that the commission keep the hearing date on its calendar for now, and if the issue needs to be revisited, we can do so as quickly as possible. Thank you.
Oh, I don't know, Ms. Kramer. I'm not in a real optimistic mood. I mean, I feel like just deferring action on this is just going to require that we get everybody ginned up for an ad hoc, which I certainly don't mind. But don't you kind of feel like this information is the crux of the case, and once Verizon has it, they're going to feel duty-bound to give it a full and thorough examination, which they are likely reticent to do under the gun?
Yes, I absolutely agree with that, and I'm convinced Ms. Moore will want to respond to whatever they file. And I just don't think it can be done in the next 2 weeks. But if by chance what they produce is what Orbitcom has said all along, well, then there really isn't much more for them to do. I don't know. I don't know if that'd be the case or not, but I think you should we should be looking at a new hearing date personally.
Yeah, that's where I think I'm headed to. All right, other commissioner comments or questions?
I guess I am optimistic today. I think it can be done in 2 weeks. I don't know if you had it by the end of the week, as Ms. Moore said, that's the 28th. You've got a full week to take that information, manipulate it, and then that still gives until the following Wednesday to actually get into town and present the case. If I'm looking at... Unless I'm looking at the wrong hearing date in my...
It's the 9th. Monday is a holiday.
Yep.
There, are you looking? Yep. So
it's the 9th, right?
Right.
Yeah.
I think where it'd come in tight is just filing of testimony and responding to it. But again, not knowing what the information's going to be, I don't know.
Okay.
Unless there are any other commissioner comments or questions, is there a motion? I will move that the commission reset the hearing dates and instruct parties to work together to select new hearing dates. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Colbeck, I think you're right. I think we could get this done. Maybe this is more... sometimes I get concerned when commissioners, when I get information quite close to hearing. Sometimes I feel as though it just squeezes me a bit tight to make sure that I'm fully prepared. So parties may be able to be prepared. The question is whether or not, you know, this commissioner can. But I think you're right. It's doable, and if we keep the hearing dates, then I'll be ready. So any further discussion on the motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
No.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 2-1. With that, the final question is, shall the commission grant the request to supplement pre-filed direct testimony? We'll hear from the parties. Verizon?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, as I've indicated, we timely asked for this information well in advance of when we filed our testimony. What we received came basically a business day and a half before we had to file our testimony. Our request is simply to address what we find out of these records and no more. We're not going to expand our testimony in any other fashion. We would consider if we respond solely to these issues. Should that need arise, we would ask for an opportunity to do so. I will also represent that if we look at the data and determine we do not need to supplement our testimony, I would notify the staff. And for that matter, I could do a notice to the records indicating we have no intention of supplementing the testimony. But until we see the data, we just don't know.
Ms. Moore?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As long as Verizon's ability to supplement is limited to any issue raised by the disclosure of the new information, and we doubt there'll be much, I don't necessarily have an objection to that, and Orbicom would simply reserve the right to either respond in writing or at the time of the hearing to whatever new testimony would be offered by Verizon.
Staff?
I would agree with Ms. Moore that that would work for a procedure schedule.
Okay. Any questions or comments by commissioners? Hearing none, is there any action? I would move that we grant the request to supplement pre-filed direct testimony, that testimony be limited to new information, and that Orbicom be given an opportunity to respond if necessary. Any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, commissioners.
Yes, thank you. Okay.
With your permission, the Verizon folks will get off the phone and the bridge, if that's all right.
Sure, absolutely.
Thank you. Have a good day.
What I'd like to do, subject to my colleague's approval, is let's deal with the USF filings where we don't have any confidential questions. Get those off the table. Save those we do have confidential questions for till the end. Does that make sense? Okay.
Sounds good.
Okay. Thank you.
Just make sure I'm following on my paper. What do we have left? Just so.
We've got, in my mind, the USF dockets, and then we have telecom item number one, which is exemption from developing company-specific cost-based rates, which is the Midco RLEC issue.
Okay.
To use shorthand.
That's right.
And the pending Midco motion. So. All right, with that, let's move to the main agenda, telecom item number two. We do have four entities that are requesting our certification for the use of the USF funds. Those companies are Midconnect Communications, Fort Randall Telephone, WWC, doing business as Alltel, and Faith Municipal Telephone Company. I think we'll let the filings speak for themselves and see if First off, staff wants to address any of those four specifically with questions or issues that they want to bring to the commissioner's attention. If there are none, then we'll move to commissioner questions. And if do we have any non-confidential questions on any of these items?
I have the TC09068. I'd like to ask some confidential questions about that.
Yeah, I would have, yeah, okay. Any non-confidential questions on any of these? I have, is anybody representing Faith Municipal Telephone?
Yes, this is Cindy Grosvenor in Consortia Consulting.
Yes, I'm Darla Rogers. I'm representing the City of Faith, and I had asked Cindy to be on the phone as the consultant in case she did have any questions.
Great, perfect. I'm going to ask my question very generally. Your answer, you may want to give, you may want to go into confidential session to answer that, in which case that's fine. Looking at the filing made by Faith, looks as though it is consistent with, you know, the USF requirements. I would have some question as to the level of capital investment as opposed to operating investment and long-term the trend of that capital investment. Can Faith Municipal Telephone Company say anything to make this commission feel more confident about that level of capital investment?
I believe we would prefer to answer that question in confidence.
Sure, great. Then we'll move Faith and Western Wireless Altel to the back. Any questions on Mid-Continent or Fort Randall? With that, I would think that we could take action on those two dockets. Is there any commission action?
I motion in TC09-029 and TC09-065 that the commission provide a certification to the Federal Communications Commission and to the Universal Service Administration Company regarding the plan for the use of federal universal service support as proposed in each of the before-mentioned dockets.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Those two motions carry. All right. With that, let's move to telecommunications item number one. This deals with the extension of an exemption from developing company-specific cost-based switch-to-access rates in four dockets, TC09-009, 014, 022, and 031. The question before the commission today deals with Mid-Continent's motion to whether or not the commission should grant the motion for uniformity in switch-to-access rates and for an evidentiary hearing in the above-referenced dockets. This time we will look toward Mid-Continent. It should also be noted that AT&T did, just yesterday, did they join in? We'll hear from AT&T when we get there. Mid-Continent, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission. My name is Dave Gerdes. I'm a lawyer from Peer, and I represent Mid-Continent Communications. There has been hit and miss development of these dockets as it relates to where we finally got here on this motion. And so what I did and what the commission is aware of is that I did file a motion in all four dockets whereby Mid-Continent was asking for an evidentiary hearing for the commission to establish a procedural schedule and an evidentiary hearing in these four caption documents to determine whether CLEX can, whether all CLEX should adopt the incumbent rate as has been an announced goal of staff and from the way the commission has acted over the past recent time would seem to be the commission's goal as well. And Mid-Continent believes that it has been harmed by the commission's actions in that it has been treated differently than other CLEX and has been required to maintain the incumbent rate, whereas others have been able to pursue or to do business at a higher rate. And for that reason, we have provided the authority to the commission that we suggest that equal protection of the law requires that Mid-Continent be treated like all the other CLECs. And for this reason, in order for the commission to have an appropriate record in order to establish the facts that would permit the commission to make a finding under this request, we ask that the commission grant the motion and establish a procedural schedule and provide for an evidentiary hearing so that this issue can be developed appropriately, which would then, of course, permit the commission to make a reasoned decision on that issue and, of course, permit review by the courts if any party thought that was necessary. And so we ask that the commission grant the motion. I won't go through a long discussion of the Equal Protection Clause. I think the Commission understands what we're asking for, and so in the interest of time, I'll just take any questions rather than going into a long dissertation.
Thank you, Mr. Curtis. Quest, Mr. Madsen, Mr. Thompson, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is Chris Madsen in Sioux Falls, and we filed a joinder to the Mid-Continent motions yesterday and would simply stand on that to save time.
Thank you, Mr. Madsen. AT&T, any comments?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Bill Van Camp on behalf of AT&T. We're here as an IXC and not as a competitive CLEC. But certainly we would support the motion of Midco and the request that they've made for an evidentiary hearing.
Okay, thanks very much. Petitioners, I don't know what order to take things in necessarily, but Mr. Kramer, I know you're representing at least some of the petitioners.
I am, thank you. Chairman, actually, Ms. Moore was going to make the first presentation on behalf of all of the rural CLECs.
Well, I had a 50-50 shot, and I guessed wrong. My apologies, Ms. Moore. Go ahead, proceed.
No problem. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We, on behalf of all the CLECs, would object to the Mid-Continent motion as well as the joinder by both Quest and AT&T in this matter. The commission has had ample opportunity in a number of motion hearings now to hear the various arguments of the parties. And the two issues that I continuously come back to as being crucial in these dockets are as follows. The first of which is what I would consider an erroneous premise advanced by Mid-Continent that the CLECs who are involved in this docket, that their tariffs have in fact expired because their settlement stipulations expired earlier this year. I think that's a very erroneous premise from both a factual and a legal standpoint. I believe all of the CLECs who are present before you this morning for consideration filed requests for extension of their exemptions prior to the expiration of those settlement and stipulations. Moreover, I believe all of them have now had their current access rates approved on a temporary basis. And under those facts and circumstances, as is well set out by the filed rate doctrine, those tariffs are still valid, and those rates, most importantly, are still valid. So having a hearing to essentially prove that a tariff is invalid, that's strictly a legal issue, and there certainly would be no basis to do so under the facts and under the law. The second crucial issue that I come back to here is the purpose of the hearing requested by Midco. And if one looks at the pleading that I believe was filed last week by Midco, they asked for a hearing to determine whether the commission should order that all CLECs mirror the incumbent rate going forward. Again, to a certain extent, this is an issue that's been decided at least on a temporary basis through the commission's actions of approving the temporary or the rates on a temporary basis for all of these CLECs. So therefore, the purpose of the hearing really is still up in the air. And ultimately, what we've got here is a hearing at which there are no defined factual or legal standards for any of the parties to adhere to. And what we then have is really not an efficient use of either the commission's time or any of the parties' time. From a practical standpoint, when one typically looks at what commission and staff look for a hearing, they look for a discovery process, they look for the filing of pre-filed testimony on the issues. As of right now, given the status of the ongoing CLEC rulemaking docket and the fact there is, as of yet, no resolution on the ultimate form or shape that those rules might take, there simply are no standards. And when looking at what sort of pre-filed testimony one might offer, there simply is absolutely no way under which any of the parties in this case can define the issues. And ultimately, what the CLECs in this case did was to ask MNCO to better define those issues that would ultimately be presented at a hearing. And the response was essentially that the commission should look at whether the CLEC should mirror the quest rate going forward. That's a legal issue, not a factual issue, and one which certainly doesn't merit a hearing because the CLECs in this case would submit that issue's already been decided by the commission. With regard to the equal protection argument, that too is a matter of law. And I think if the commission were to look seriously at that issue, first of all, you need to look at equal protection law itself. And fair does not necessarily mean equal treatment under the law as it relates to equal protection. So as an initial matter, there certainly isn't anything there that MNCO can't prove within its own docket that it currently made to amend its current tariff or in the rulemaking docket itself that it needs to somehow do through the various CLECs which are before you this morning. And more than that, if we were to get into that equal protection analysis, I think what we would end up with would be a very significant discovery process and all sorts of other things whereby MNCO would actually open up an analysis of its own network costs and expenses in order for it to support that it has somehow been treated differently from the others. And without any applicable CLEC rules in place at this point in time or without any well-defined evidentiary standards going forward, I think we again end up in an even greater procedural morass than where we may currently be. So I think under these facts and circumstances, neither the facts nor the law justify either the positions that have been advanced by MNCO, nor do they justify that a hearing be awarded in this particular case. It simply doesn't make sense at this particular time. Well, I certainly can understand MNCO's frustrations, and I can say as a lawyer I probably wouldn't do anything different than what MNCO has done. It doesn't necessarily mean that they have a factual and a legal leg to stand on at this point in time. So, therefore, the CLECs would ask that the commission deny the motion for hearing. Thank you.
Well, I still have a 50-50 chance of being wrong. So rather than pick either Ms. Rogers or Mr. Kramer, which of you would like, which of you is next?
Mr. Chairman, actually, I am next, and I will make it very brief. Ms. Moore is correct in that all of us are in the same posture with respect to the MNCO motion. MNCO first challenged our tariffs, and it's clear that the tariffs have been approved. MNCO then says, well, let's have an evidentiary hearing to determine that all CLECs are the same and that, therefore, we are all entitled to the same rate based on an equal protection argument. Well, the fact is equal protection doesn't mean just because you have the same name that you get the same treatment. In fact, the courts have consistently held that if there's a rational basis for a distinction, that distinction is upheld. Of course, in these cases, the rational basis for the distinction is the different network characteristics between our companies and MNCO. Sometimes you have to be careful for what you ask for, because if we go into an evidentiary hearing in the form that MNCO asked, certainly we need to look at what MNCO's network characteristics are and are they different from the rest of us. And I think we all know that the answer to that's going to be yes, and therefore a different treatment of the CLECs would be appropriate, and therefore there's no reason to even go into that evidentiary hearing. Finally, any of the arguments or objections that MNCO has with respect to its claim that it's being treated differently can be addressed in the rulemaking document or docket, because after all, in these dockets, all we have asked for is that our current rates continue continue pending the rules in the rulemaking docket. And this commission has already approved the extension of these tariffs. So there's really nothing much left in this docket until we get to the rules in the rulemaking docket. So I would also encourage the commission to deny the MITCO motion.
Thanks, Mr. Kramer.
Thank you. My name is Darla Rogers, and I represent Midstate, Telcom, and also RC Communications in these dockets. One of the advantages of being the last is that I don't have a lot more to add to what's already been said, other than I'll concur in the comments of my colleagues. I would maybe just invite us to step back and take a look at the larger picture here and how we even, or why we even started down this path. I think that from a higher level, maybe we are all trying to achieve the same goal. I think that when speaking in particular with regard to Midstate, when they initially filed a motion with this commission, it was that you would exempt them from having to file a cost-based switched access study in order to determine its rate. One of the reasons initially was because it was a new company and didn't have that information, but then as time went on, it became apparent that really we didn't have in place rules that really specifically addressed what is the appropriate methodology for CLECs to develop or determine their rates. And in fact, in one of the filings that Midcontinent filed in the Midstate dockets or series of dockets, Midstate said that, in fact, when they asked this commission to disapprove a settlement that we had reached with staff, Midstate said that what we were looking for, what everyone was seeking, was a consistent approach to CLEC switched access. And I think that that is still the goal, a consistent methodology to determine what is the appropriate rate for CLECs, because those rules do not exist currently. And because of that, then, this commission, I think, recognized that. And you opened or converted a rulemaking docket into a docket that is going to hopefully make those decisions are going to be made. What are the appropriate rules? And so the goal of our clients, of the CLECs that we represent in these dockets, is to get to that point. So what we've said in our filings is just keep the status quo, keep everything the way it is. We have approved tariffs on file. Keep those in place until we know what the rules are. And then we will comply with those rules and come forward and figure out what our rates are going to be under the rules that you ultimately implement. And you have been very diligent in seeking input and discussion from the different parties with regard to that rulemaking docket. And I bring this to your attention just to point out then, or maybe concur with the comments that have been made. Since that really is the case, and we're all trying to seek the same end result, we really don't need to have an evidentiary hearing in these dockets. We don't need to have that evidentiary hearing because you've already made a ruling with regard to the rates, so they're going to continue. And we don't have to have, we don't need an evidentiary hearing on the equal protection part of it because, as has been previously mentioned, we don't believe that these dockets are really the correct place to raise that issue, and I don't believe it's been properly keyed up by Midcontinent. I don't believe that they have properly pointed to any statutes or administrative rules that do not treat all the CLECs equally. Different CLECs can choose to avail themselves of different rules that are out there, but they're all treated the same. So for those reasons, I don't believe that there is really any additional advantage to having an evidentiary hearing in these dockets. I believe that we can achieve the goal by doing what you've done so far, and that is maintaining the status quo in these four dockets. And what these CLECs have said is, Once we get the rules in place and we know what they are, we'll come in and we'll abide by them and comply with them. And so that's what we're asking in these cases, and we would urge you to deny the motion of Mid-Continent. Thank you.
We've been going for a while. A chair needs a break. So before hearing from staff, maybe we'll take a short five-minute break. We'll hear from staff, and then we'll take some questions for the parties. So we'll see everybody back in, at 27 now? We'll be back at 32. And rebuttal, yes. Thanks, Mr. Curtis. We're back on the web. Thanks for allowing a break. And we will hear from staff.
Thank you. This is Karen Kramer from staff. And I would echo the comments made by the rural CLECs. And if you have questions, you know, I am available. I too believe that if at best this would be a legal issue, there are no facts to be found here. I just have no clue what we would go to hearing on. The subtlety of Mr. Gerdes's argument escapes me, and I'm sure it's there, but I just don't know what we would have an evidentiary hearing on at this point. And I believe any issues they have at all, they can intervene once the rules are out and the parties, the CLECs, decide how they want to go forward. Then at that point, when a docket is opened, Quest and AT&T and Mid-Continent can intervene, and all of this will be determined at that point. And so at this point, I would recommend that the commission deny the motion for an evidentiary hearing.
Thank you. Rebuttal. Mr. Gerdes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of things. First, the reason we need an evidentiary hearing was best exemplified by Mr. Kramer's comment. That is that there has to be a rational basis for a distinction. Well, you have to have facts in order to distinguish between various companies and their situations. And so I would submit that you need an evidentiary hearing in order to establish the facts, and that would support Mid-Continent's contention that the commission is treating Mid-Continent differently than it is other CLECs. We have to have the facts upon which to base that contention, and then the commission has to decide one way or the other. Ms. Rogers talked about the fact that there was no statute or rule that was treating Mid-Continent differently. We're not talking about a statute or rule. We're talking about an informal commission policy, which is treating Mid-Continent differently than other CLECs, as is exemplified by the settlements that commission and commission staff have permitted over the years, which permit higher access rates and different access rates, when in fact the correct answer is for it to be the incumbent rate. Ms. Moore talked about the fact that there was an erroneous premise that the CLEX tariffs have expired on the part of Mid-Continent. We did file a brief on that, Your Honor, and the point in our brief simply was that if you look at each of those orders back when those tariffs were first approved, and I'm looking at here, it just so happens to be the Mid-State order, but they're all the same. And as we said in the brief, it was not the tariffs that were ordered approved by the commission. It was the settlement stipulation only. And therefore, when the settlement stipulation expired, those tariffs could not extend beyond the terms of the stipulation. If you read the order, it says ordered that the joint motion for approval of settlement stipulation is granted. Okay, you approved the settlement stipulation. It's ordered that the settlement stipulation is approved. All right, you've approved the settlement stipulation. It is ordered that Mid-State's request for an extension of an exemption from establishing company-specific cost-based switched access rate is granted. Okay. But, and that's it. There's no ordering paragraph that approves the tariff. And so for that reason, I would submit that the tariffs have expired and that those existing rates cannot continue beyond as provided in the tariff. And so we believe, Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, that there's ample cause, ample reason to reconfigure these dockets and to have a procedural schedule where we can develop the legal questions and to provide for discovery and then an evidentiary hearing.
Questions? Mr. Gerdes, you had just said in your oral arguments that the proper rate for access should be the incumbent's rate. And I would tell you first off that, you know, I am happy to see that Mid-Continent's position has evolved a little bit, because in an earlier docket, Mid-Continent, one witness, I mean, I don't know if the word absurdity was used, but, you know, one witness mentioned that it was almost absurd to imagine that the ILEC rate would have any connection to what a legitimate CLEC access rate should be. I guess my confusion is, if you're asking for the ILEC rate to be the, I mean, I'm looking through the rules in 2010-27, and I just don't see any authority for the commission to order any of these four companies at this time to mirror the ILEC rate. Am I missing anything, any authority that the commission would have?
Well, the first thing I'd say, Mr. Chairman, is that staff for the last several years has said that the commission should implement a policy of adopting the incumbent rate, citing a decision of the FCC. And so that is the first part of it. And then secondly, Mid-Continent has attempted to have a cost study approved. That hasn't happened. And so if it's not appropriate for a cost study to be developed, then it seems to me that the fairest way for all CLECs to be treated the same is to have the incumbent rate be the switched access rate.
I don't dispute much of what you said about what is might be fair. I just don't see that the commission has the authority today to do what you described it should do.
Well, I suppose the first thing I'd say is that that would be the purpose of granting the motion and seeing if Mid-Continent can prove what it says can happen. Secondly, it seems to me that you know, you can look at the statutes. For instance, there is a statute that talks about the commission being able to adopt price regulation. I don't know if that applies or not. I haven't examined it in sufficient detail to know if that would apply in this instance. But we believe that the commission does in fact have the inherent ability to do what we just asked. And so the question we would say, grant the motion and say and say to Mid-Continent, prove it.
And just one more clarifying comment. You know, in response to my first question, you said, well, you know, that's what staff has pushed for and alleged. And I'm sure you, Mr. Gerdes, understand a very clear difference between what commission staff might allege the commission has the authority to do and what the commission might actually have the authority to do.
I understand that.
These three commissioners disagree with staff from time to time. And
As well you should.
Exactly what there's been some allegations by the petitioners that they wouldn't know exactly what the hearing would be about. Can you give us a very clear bullet point list of what issues Mid-Continent would want addressed in a hearing? What decisions should, you know, would be made by this commission?
what we believe that the commission, or what we believe would be proven at the hearing, would be that there is a need for there to be uniformity in the commission's treatment of CLECs, because under the law, under federal laws, all CLECs are created equal, so to speak. There's no distinction made among CLECs in any of the FCC rules or in its decisions, for that matter. A CLEC is a CLEC is a CLEC, and thus they should be all treated in the same fashion. Accepting that as the goal, then the next part of the puzzle would simply be to implement that as a policy of the commission, and if necessary, promulgate rules.
You say that the FCC doesn't make any distinction between any CLECs, but you know, Mr. Kramer, in his comments, does cite the Seventh Report and Order and Further Notice of Proposed Rulemaking in April of 2001, indicating that the, and quotes that decision, where the commission adopts 50,000 as a population threshold for how to treat rural CLECs different than non-rural CLECs.
That's on the federal side. That's not state. That's federal. That's interstate.
I must have misheard
and I'm
you.
I'm talking about intrastate.
I must have misheard you. I thought you said there hasn't been any instance where the FCC or this commission has treated CLECs differently. I must have misheard you.
Well, between interstate rates and intrastate rates, yes. That's settled law. But within South Dakota, we're dealing with intrastate rates, and we should treat all CLECs. Intrastate rate equally.
With Mr. Gertz, when I look at the settlement stipulation that was approved by the commission, it appears as though that it is the rate freeze that expires in any of those three instances. Number three, sub three, was the one that I think is controlling. Seems as though the freeze expires, not necessarily the rate. Where is my understanding of that flawed?
I'm not. Which order are you talking about?
The commission order that indicated that the CLECs would have in question, these four companies would have a rate that was agreed to based on staff and CLEC negotiations, and that rate would be that there would be a rate freeze in effect until this commission did something on the federal level. Something was done with ICC. Or 3 years,
yes.
Whichever was first.
Yes.
It appears to me in reading that what expires is a rate freeze rather than a rate.
I disagree because the penultimate issue is or 3 years. And once 3 years arrives, the rate without more expires.
Does anybody have a copy of that order handy?
Yeah, I can read.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
It says this agreed upon rate shall be frozen until, I won't say one and two, the agreed upon rate shall be frozen until 3 years from the
louder, please.
Until three.
Oh, hold on. A little louder for Commissioner Hansen, please.
Yes. It says the agreed upon rate shall be frozen until 3 years from the date hereof.
Right. And so at the end of 3 years, it goes out of existence.
I'm not entirely clear that's what it says. I mean, it says that rate will be frozen, immovable, inflexible for 3 years.
For 3 years, and after 3 years.
That's what it doesn't
it
say.
It ends.
I mean, I don't want to argue with you, counsel, but it doesn't say that. That may be what's implied. That may be what other settled case law says, but on the four corners, it does not say, and then something happens. It's silent. And if you disagree, show me where it says differently.
No, I agree that's what it says, but I think the proper interpretation is that at the end of 3 years, that rate expires.
And defaults to what?
That's a good question.
Okay. Other commissioner or advisor questions?
Perhaps someone can help me. Can you understand
am I coming through clearly?
Yeah, you're doing fine, Gary. We've got a little bit of the same problem here we've had with other folks, so I don't think it's on your end, but you're breaking up a little bit. But go ahead, and we'll tell you if it gets too bad.
Speak slowly, perhaps that will help. I'm confused a bit because the dockets that have been filed request an exemption from filing the switched access cost study for 3 months. And then they request that we approve the rate set forth for the duration of the extension, so there's a freeze. However, the filings that we have from Mid-Continent ask for items that don't seem to be a part of those dockets. They're asking for proceedings to establish uniform switched access rates and for an order to provide that CLEX mirror ILEC rates. And to me, those would seem to require their own docket to be filed. Am I wrong here?
Who do you want to take the first shot at answering?
I'm happy to hear from our counsel or counsel from either side.
Ms. Wiest, first thought?
Well, yeah, I think there is a problem because this case, I mean, the cases at issue are for an exemption. And one of the problems is that if, and I guess I was going to ask Mid-Continent a couple of questions because I'm not quite sure what their position is. But, I mean, one of the problems is that if Mid-Continent is advocating that the commission order that all CLECs mirror the incumbent rates, obviously not all CLECs have been able to be a part of this docket. And all CLECs would have absolutely no idea, unless they were following each and every docket that we have, that that would be an issue in this docket. So I just don't understand how the commission could go down that road.
Commissioner Hansen's asked some questions. I've asked some questions. Let's pause and see if any of the other parties want to respond to any of that.
This is Jim Cramer. Chairman, you have raised the issues I would have responded to Mr. Gerdes's presentation. That is specifically the Northern Valley Order of 2006 did in fact specifically approve its tariff. He didn't go on to read the rest of the order. So with respect to Northern Valley, at least, its tariff was approved in 2006, and when this commission entered its order in June of this year for the temporary extension, it also specifically approved the tariff. So I think the tariff argument is off the table. He then talked, you asked him specifically, what are we going to do with this evidentiary hearing? And he said, well, we need a hearing on uniformity because there's no federal law that treats CLECs differently. And Mr. Chairman, you did go to my brief where I specifically cited the commission to that part of the FCC's decisions and rulemaking, which says rural CLECs are different, and we can treat them differently. So this commission can do the same thing. And the purpose of the evidentiary hearing that Mr. Gerdes wants is to determine, are there differences with respect to these CLECs? And I think that should be a different docket, because then all CLECs can participate, as Ms. Wiest just pointed out to us. So this isn't the proper place to hear this, even if it's proper to hear it at all.
Thank you, Mr. Cramer. Other commissioner questions, comments?
This is Commissioner Kobach. I think the I agree that, well, I don't really understand what we would have any fearing for in the matter of the docket, TCO 931 or the others. I really don't think that a uniformity in switched access rates has anything to do with this docket. That's what I'm struggling with. Would you have an evidentiary hearing on specifically if Northern Valley meets the standards of the cost study? Is that what you're after? Or you're after actually more of a broader evidentiary hearing, I believe.
Commissioner Colbeck, I'd say that we're interested in something farther reaching, but the answer to the question of why aren't all the CLECs in this is, I believe, that we start with four and we keep going. Eventually, everybody has to come in for a cost study.
But then I guess that would just lead me to believe, Mr. Kramer, that this is probably not the correct avenue for this type of procedure.
Well, I'd respectfully disagree, because I think this is where we start with the first four, and then whenever the cost studies roll over, it would be appropriate to handle that CLEC.
So you're not, I mean, you specifically stated in your motion you want a hearing to determine whether the commission should order that all CLECs upon expiration of their previously approved switch access rate mirror the incumbent rate going forward.
You're right, and that is perhaps incorrectly worded, but obviously, since it only relates to four CLECs, that's all it could apply to. And then as the other CLECs come in for cost studies, the same Mid-Continent would intervene and we'd do the same thing until it's all taken care of.
Well, if the commission went to an evidentiary hearing, would it be Mid-Continent's position that all CLECs should mirror the incumbent LECs rate? Is that your position?
Yes.
And so you've totally changed your position from the position you had last November.
That's correct. We couldn't get a if we can't have the rate that the other CLECs have, then through a cost study, then let's put all the CLECs at the same rate at the incumbent level. I mean, we just wanted to level the playing field one way or the other.
Where have you been prohibited by the commission from actually having your cost study go to hearing on this? In the order where the commission talked about your cost study, it says Mid-Continent shall be required to file its cost study-based proposed rates as a formal rate tariff filing.
Which that part has been done. We filed it.
Where has the commission ordered you that you cannot file a cost study and get cost study-based rates?
Because the commission in that docket disapproved of the cost study as it was presented to the commission.
It told you to file, actually, the cost study as a rate tariff filing.
Yeah. And the tariff has never been approved yet.
It'd still be a pending docket, right?
Could be, yes.
Where, and you say the legal authorities, MIDCO wants a hearing to determine whether the legal authorities cited in comparable motions support the commission's ruling that all CLECs must adopt the incumbent carrier switched access rates. When did the commission ever make that ruling?
Could you point that out to me, please? Okay. That's a reference to, I started out earlier talking about how this motion that applies to all four, the reason I made the motion in that fashion was because it was sort of a hit and miss proposition as these four dockets developed. And when I'm talking about a comparable motion in motions in each of the caption documents, I'm talking about the motions that were originally made in this motion that has all four dockets on it was intended to subsume all into one document so it wouldn't be confusing.
So it would be MIDCO's position that the current quest rate as an incumbent LEC is a just and reasonable rate for Mid-Continent?
So long as it's the rate for all other CLECs, yes.
But haven't we just established that this would only involve four CLECs, this procedure?
Until the next CLEC came up, and then they could also transition into it. Came up for a cost study. They have to come in every 3 years. So
in this case, the commission could decide mid-continence rate, these proceedings? Or this wouldn't affect your rate? If the commission made that determination, you said it would apply to the four CLECs. So we would tell these four CLECs that they had to mirror the incumbent's rate. But since Mid-Continent is an intervener but not a petitioner in this case, Mid-Continent would not be required to do that.
Well, Mid-Continent would be required in its own docket that you just mentioned.
Just one more question, but this is the only issue that you have, that the commission should order uniformity of rates. That's your only factual issue in these cases?
Yes.
Thank you.
You know, this has been a long trail, but, I mean, to provide some context, commission staff, I think, was driving toward the very approach that you're describing Mid-Continent wants to see now, which is as cost studies, you know, as rates come up, that then there's sort of a plan to work down toward the incumbent rate. I mean, I just wonder if all of this involvement and all of these, you know, I wonder if we actually haven't retarded the movement toward that end goal in the last 12 months.
Mr. Chairman, we thought about that long and hard. I think the conclusion was reached that we'd waited long enough and we wanted to see if we could effect change more quickly because, of course, the first thing we got were these three-year step-downs that never did get to the incumbent rate. You know, you have one of them, the Mitchell Telecom, I believe, if I recall correctly, that's the one that does, in fact, go to the incumbent rate. But the other three only got to, I can't remember, 11.5 cents or something like that and didn't go any further. And so you've got this helter-skelter patchwork of switched access rates when what's needed is a broad-based movement to put everybody at the same level at some predictable time, which we don't have. Now, you can quarrel with the way Mid-Continent has done this, but we are trying to be an agent of change to get everything spread out evenly. If this isn't the right way, you can certainly tell us that, and we can try something else, but Mid-Continent is dedicated to the proposition that there ought to be parity in the switched access rates among CLECs.
Okay, other questions? If there are not, I am going to move the Mid-Continent's motion for an evidentiary hearing be denied. Because the evidentiary hearing they requested is based on the uniformity and switched access rates, and I just don't see any possible way we can get from here to there with the commission with the authority that's been given to the commission. I will tell you one take-home lesson for me that Mid-Continent has made is that the settlement stipulation that's in limbo between these four companies and staff calls for sort of an in perpetuity. You know, it doesn't have a date certain where that exemption ends. You know, this is just one commissioner speaking. I mean, I do understand how that's probably not good policy. And that at some point, we need to have these companies probably step up and show that they're deserving of an exemption because they don't have the various capabilities required under the rules to make their own cost study, or they just need to file a cost study. I mean, that point, Mr. Gerdes, it's been received by at least one commissioner. I just think this filing before us doesn't do that. It doesn't request that be done and isn't the right mechanism, I think, to affect the change that Mid-Continent is saying that it wants to see. So with that, are there other comments on the pending motion to deny?
Other than the freeze, I guess addressing the freeze a little bit, I know you and Mr. Gruters had a conversation about that. I really don't see how when a freeze ends that it has to go one way or the other. It's you can go up, you can go down, you can go to Leica Plus, you can go anywhere you want to. So I guess I understand your point that you want to know what happens after the freeze. I understand that. But right now, according to the rules, I don't think that it says it has to go anywhere. So that's just this commissioner's opinion on that.
Other commissioner comments? Okay. Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. The motion, again, is to deny the Mid-Continent motion for an evidentiary hearing. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. All right. Thank you very much. With that, we will proceed to, I think the only things we have left are two universal service dockets, specifically TC09-068, which is Alltel, and 075, which is Faith Municipal Telephone. Well, either Mr. Wazurek or Ms. Grosmer are going to have to drop off the line. The first one listed is Alltel, so we will ask, Cindy, can you drop off the line? We'll go off the Internet. When we come back onto the Internet, if you could listen to the Internet stream, we'll come back on and you'll be able to hear, and we'll wait for you to get on before we proceed.
So that means I hang up and then dial back in?
Yes, you'll need to do that.
Okay.
Thanks very much.
Listen to the Internet in the meantime to know when to dial back in.
Yeah, and you won't hear much on the Internet for a while. You'll hear silence until we come back online.
Oh, okay.
Great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
With that, let's ask if anyone else is on the telephone line. Anyone else on the telephone?
Commissioner Hansen.
Yeah, perfect. Good.
Alltel has no objection to Commissioner Hansen being on the line.
All right. With that, we are going to go off the Internet, and we have cleared the room for the purposes of discussing confidential information. Is there any objection to that? Hearing none, we'll go off the Internet. This is the Public Utilities Commission. We are back out of our session where we're discussing confidential or proprietary information. Other questions for the petitioner? Hearing none, any commissioner comments or action?
I'll motion TC09-068 that the commission provided certification to the Federal Communications Commission and to Universal Service Administration Company regarding the plan for the use of federal universal support as proposed in the above-mentioned docket.
Motion has been made. Is there any discussion on the pending motion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thank you, Alltel.
Thank you.
With that,
I will make an effort.
We're going to pause just a moment to make sure we've got everybody we need to have here. Ms. Rogers is here. Ms. Grosner, do we have you on the line yet?
Yes, sir, I'm here.
Oh, perfect, great. Thanks very much. Do we have anybody else on the telephone line other than Commissioner Hansen? Okay, with that, we are on the Internet. First, we'll see if there are any non-confidential questions for Faith Municipal Telephone. Hearing none, we will go into off-the-Internet session in order to discuss the confidential portions of the filing by Faith. Unless there's any objection, we'll go off. Okay, here we go. The Utilities Commission, we're back on the Internet. Questions dealt generally with the level of capital investment by Faith Municipal Telephone Company. Any other questions or commissioner comments on this docket? Hearing none, is there any action? I'll move.
Mr. Chairman, I'll move.
Go ahead, Commissioner, go ahead.
TC09075, that the Commission provide a certification to the Federal Communications Commission and the Universal Service Administration Company regarding the plan for the use of federal of USF support as proposed by FAITH.
Perfect. Motion has been made. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll proceed to vote. Hansen?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. That concludes our agenda. I don't think we've got anything left to do. Obviously, you draw your attention to the announcements that we have at the end of the main agenda. And also, one of the commission advisors noted that staff has done a very thorough job on these USF dockets this year. Lots of great questions asked in discovery requests, data requests, and made it a lot easier for us to do our job with that information handy. So thanks very much to staff for their hard work on those dockets.
I heard Libri Baker. I'm not sure if I heard Thurber, but I for sure heard Libri Baker.
Sort of a mixed bag on that front, sure. If there's no further business to come for the commission, is there a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Motion has been made. We'll proceed to vote. Hanson?
Aye.
Colbeck?
Aye.
Johnson votes aye. Motion carries 3-0. Thank you. Have a good day. Mm-hmm.